Well, Joe.
Yo.
It's Armageddon again.
What do you mean again?
Yeah.
Where?
Every week. Where Middle East.
Middle East. Armageddon.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
We didn't do a show last week, and last Friday, Hezbollah's leader, entire leadership, but most particularly, famously, Hassan Nasrallah, was taken out.
When? Last Friday?
Last Friday night, wasn't it?
What day is today? Sunday. Was it only 3 days ago? Yeah. No, it was more. Whatever. Sometime last week, no?
No, that's what I meant. Friday, the week before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Friday the week before, yeah.
That's pretty historic. I mean, he's been there 30 years. It's really only in the Middle East. It certainly would. That's quite an earthquake for the region. He's famous there. It's a small country. It's Lebanon, I know, but he's a very high profile figure in the Middle East. In the West, the obituaries are simple. He's a terrorist. He's gone. Moving on. It's not that simple over there.
But it is simple, Neil. It was only 100 years ago that none of these countries existed. You know? We created them.
Who's we, white man?
Exactly. White man.
Sykes and Pico.
We created them. And ever since, we've owned them. Structured them in a certain way so that, you know, that they would remain compliant and controllable, and, you know, keep them at odds, and so that we can, at odds with each other, so that we can continue to control the main reason that we set it up that way in the first place, which was to have access to the natural resources there. It's basically like a...
And have a say in how they're used.
No, own them, basically.
To
a large extent.
Own, yeah.
I mean...
Do they still?
Huh?
Does BP still actually have the ownership of, say... Where were they? Kuwait. I think it's owned by the Kuwaiti...
Yeah, but and we own them, so... You know what I'm saying? These are all clan.
Yeah.
These are all clan regimes, you know.
And that includes Lebanon.
No, I mean the ones
which was a French colony.
Well, it was at the time, yeah. So, you know, they just got away from us in a certain sense. But we have to keep them in line.
We
have to keep them in line. When they get out of hand, you know, when they start, they don't really know their place. You know, I mean, they forget their place. And we do that by Israel, obviously. And that's the reason we created Israel was to be the kind of like, as RFK Jr. called it, the
beachhead in the Middle East.
Yeah, aircraft carrier, land-based aircraft.
He used both terms. Yeah. Remarkably, he wanted to really emphasize the point, so he said both beachhead and our aircraft carrier.
Yeah, well, same
and
thing.
If we don't have it, we'd have to create it, because otherwise Russia, Iran and China would
dominate the region,
Middle East,
dominate
and
the,
thus...
The oil
and gas.
It would be very bad for America. America would
the
be,
energy spigot.
Yeah, America would be in big trouble, you know, economically, as a country, as a nation, as the nation we know it today, and as a global hegemon. It would be all over, you know.
So over-leveraged.
Yeah, well, you've got the petrodollar, obviously, that's been in place for a very long time. That kind of thing. It's not just about having access. It's not as crass as, like, we're stealing all your oil type thing. You have to give it to us all, but we basically control... created the countries and control the governments that are sitting on the countries that are sitting on the governments of the countries that are sitting on the oil, and we control them in many different ways, have done for a very long time. So we're not about to give up on it. Like, we're not, you know, we need to get a couple of upstarts, you know. I think they can, you know.
Oh Jesus, 30 years!
I know, but
they took their sweet time with Hezbollah.
I know, but they were controlled all through that period of time, obviously, like, you know what I mean? There was a process of managing them. They've been managed ever since. Any of them that were, you know, upstarty,
it's funny,
they were being managed for a very long time. But
when you go on the US government website. Not sure which one, but it's definitely a .gov. And they're listing for why Hezbollah is on a terrorism list, classified as a terrorist group, which began in 97, ironically, long after it was created in 1982. Some of the examples they give, the three most recent examples are farcical. Can people hear that? That crackling? I can hear. Please hold. Adjustments being made here. Yeah? I'm good now.
I'll just go over here then.
Yeah, don't move that mic. It seems to be Joe's mic. It's crackling.
I'll just stand right in front of it like this. I'll tape it to my forehead. Go ahead.
The three most recent citations for why the US government considered Hezbollah a terrorist group were the most recent one is 2012. I think that was when Rafiq Hariri, the former Lebanese prime minister, was assassinated in a massive car bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Was that earlier? 2000s, whatever.
By Israel.
Yeah, but not officially. Officially, no, it went down as there was a whole trial and UN investigation and so on. And then there was a trial by media, which blamed it on Hezbollah, as if they blew up their own Beirut neighborhood to get their own prime minister. Anyway, but ironically, in its early days, Hezbollah did start out with the tactics, which you would say are tactics of terror. So that would be airplane hijackings, mm-hmm. which was a 70s thing and was really on its way out. I think they did it once, and that was to demand the release of some of their members, maybe been taken captive by the IDF across the border. But they did it once, and that was it. It was they did actually start out with the tactics that by then had been condemned the world over as terrorism, so they stopped that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really about it. There are a couple of other bombings. There's one in Bulgaria. Maybe that's the one in 2012 I'm thinking of. Again, super dodgy as to how that was blamed on Hezbollah. There were two guys, and they got passports from some other dodgy guy, and this guy maybe knew someone who was in Hezbollah. It was a stitch-up, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to pin any actual terrorism beyond direct military-to-military contacts they've had, of course, over the decades with the IDF and the Israelis. But if you ask anyone on the street, maybe take a quick poll, and yeah, they're global terrorists. The other famous one that stuck is attributed to Hezbollah is the two or three bombings in Buenos Aires in the early 90s. And they were investigated up the wazoo.
That was Iran, no? They blamed it on
Hezbollah/Iran. Mm. Iran via, there's quite a sizable Lebanese community there, so that would be how they had influence to do it. But it wasn't. That was almost certainly Mossad.
Right.
A false flag, a self-inflicted attack on the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. Anyway, and that's basically, in a nutshell, their history. The whole purpose was, of course, the reason they started was because of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon 42 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are 42 years later, and it's essentially the same. The cycle has come full. Israel's bombing the hell out of Beirut and Lebanon, southern Lebanon. And the resistance that began from the last time that happened, in a big way, excluding 2006, which was a third time, I suppose, in these decades this happened. That's how Hezbollah formed. And now it's still there, but taking out the leadership like that is, we'll see. I think it's broken. Apparently there's been another strike recently that killed the next guy who was likely to take up leadership.
His cousin? Who was named? Already.
Okay. It's not over for them yet, as we'll see. Israelis tried to ground incursion a few days ago and fell back after, I think, 8 IDF soldiers were killed. That's too much for Israel, so they've reverted to terror bombing.
Need to soften it up more, yeah?
Yeah.
As they say, what they call it.
It's just such a... You're right, when you see the broad sweep of things, you know, it's kind of... It's just tragic. Like, Nasrallah would have believed... I don't know, maybe he's a man who was always close to death and he knew he could be martyred at any moment, but it's like, why would you bother? You know, what an end after all that.
Why would who bother?
Nasrallah or anyone, to stand up to the Israelis, you know, if they're just going to ultimately use an enormous amount of firepower and take you out. You see, I suppose that you'd have bothered because 10 and even, yeah, even just 10 years ago, Israel couldn't have done that.
Why would you bother doing what? Standing up to Israel, is it?
Yeah.
And that's what gets you taken out?
Creating an army and having it ready, okay.
Well, you need to create an army. I mean, not no, creating an army, but I suppose, yeah.
But then they just decapitate it. The whole leadership, boom.
You can have it as a defensive army, you know. But you're saying, why would you bother harassing Israel in a certain sense over Palestine? That's really what started it, right? I mean, they can have an army. Nasrallah and Hezbollah can exist, or Hezbollah can exist as an army under Nasrallah and that kind of stuff to... as in the way that we're formed, it'd just be a defensive army within Lebanon, right?
Okay.
So the question is, why would you like harass Israel over?
Cause okay.
That's what's actually happened. They started militarily harassing Israel over Gaza.
Okay.
Still a good question. Why wouldn't you just go? Well, you know,
there's no
the Palestinians have kind of. You know,
there's nothing
made, to be done. Made their bed in a certain sense, you know. Well, I think part of the reason is, or maybe, yeah, it probably gets closer to the truth, is the Lebanon's foreign minister, so now not a member of Hezbollah and stuff, and he is telling Christine Amanpour on PBS this.
You saying Hassan Nasrallah had agreed to a ceasefire just moments before he was assassinated?
He agreed, yes. We agreed completely, Lebanon agreed to a ceasefire, but consulting with Hezbollah, the speaker, Mr. Berri, consulted with Hezbollah, and we informed the Americans and the French that what happened.
So,
and they told us and that Mr. Netanyahu also agreed.
So you go.
When? That day or close to it?
Just before he was killed, yeah. So that kind of puts a different spin on your question of why would you bother, you know? Why would you bother doing what? Why would you bother, the way we presented, why would you bother attacking Israel? Well...
So
his mistake wasn't necessarily to attack Israel. His mistake was to want to stop attacking Israel.
Is it possible that the PR that the Israeli government put out of Netanyahu having just given his speech at the UN General Assembly in New York and then going to a hotel and making a call that ordered in the airstrikes to kill Nasrallah, that's not what happened there? That was him...
Probably not. I don't think it would be on video, you know what I mean? Necessarily. I mean, it might be done for propaganda purposes, but that's not how it works. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you don't go, oh, so Mr. President, we're all fingers and thumbs here. We don't know what to do in Israel, you know? We've just kind of woken up and, what should we do today? Who should we bomb today? And he says, you should kill Nasrallah. Yeah. Send a few bombs in and have you found out where Nasrallah is? Yeah, we know where he is. All right, bomb him. So Netanyahu's doing that off the cuff at the UN.
So,
or maybe it was that, I mean, there's not a plausible reason that they were looking for him. Eventually they found, they got information, got intelligence that he was going to be in this particular area. Then they have to consult with the Prime Minister to approve the hit on Nasrallah, and that's what he was doing, you know. So, and then they take a video of him doing it for propaganda purposes. But if it's for propaganda purposes, then can you believe that it was that's actually what was happening? I don't believe that that's so how that kind of thing
you're suggesting
works, you know?
It's possible that something over the head of the formal Israeli government carried that out.
I think most things happen over the head of the Israeli government in the same way that most things happen over the head of the White House.
So a secret team hit to keep it going, to kill in his cradle any truce between Hezbollah and Israel.
Yeah. Because we're setting a course here, you know. We're not for stopping, you know. We're going to remake the Middle East. Can't stop halfway. Look bad, you know.
So you the American, well, if you stop the American deep state.
Yeah. I mean, they're hand in glove, obviously. I mean, they're on first, effectively, in the Middle East. Like we were just saying, Israel is America's bridgehead or its aircraft carrier in the Middle East. You know, they own it, right? And they have, you know, scope, a lot of scope to operate as well under the cover of Israeli operations. You know what I mean? I mean, how do we really know who's up there, who's dropping bombs? You know what I mean? Or any particular bomb? Sure, obviously Israelis are doing it, but how do you know that if there is or isn't a US jet or a number of US jets up there operating on their own initiative? You know?
Have you ever seen the new US embassy in Beirut? It's the entire mountain. It's a fortress. They didn't build that to represent the interests of Americans living in Lebanon, a country of 5 million people.
No.
It's massive. It's like Baghdad's green zone, but bigger. And it was just completed like a couple of years ago, which suggests in time for Middle East mayhem, right? So that's intriguing. Which means BB's left holding, which would mean BB's left holding the country, because he's just given a speech about peace in his usual aggressive way about how Israel can get anyone. But he was speaking about Iran, though. He wasn't threatening Nasrallah or Lebanon in the speech, I think, not directly.
Exactly, yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah, it's...
But it's plausible.
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying it necessarily went against. I mean, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. Against Netanyahu's plan. But that is something that has happened, you know, many times before. At least in the context of when there's possibility for some kind of peace to break out, that the primary warring party doesn't want to break out. Then some provocation happens, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's a recurring pattern.
Yeah.
Something that blows my mind. I mean, the Israeli strikes in Lebanon have been insane before, during, and since. But that specific airstrike that took out Nasrallah. Have a look at this from the U.S. Naval Institute. It's impressive how precise a picture they have as to what happened during that strike. Can you do a search for two factors? Two factors in the Israeli strike, the one that killed Nasrallah last Friday, stand out. The first is quantity. According to a U.S. Air Force Central Command report on the 2003 invasion of Iraq, U.S. Air Forces expended a total of 24 GBU-24 and GBU-28. Mm-hmm. That's 4,000-pound bunker busters in the entire conflict against the Iraqi military.
2 ton, yeah.
Last Friday, Israel dropped up to 3 times as many weapons in one night. Considering the targets, however, helps explain the apparent overkill. I think they go on to say that's because Nasrallah was in a an underground facility that was, what, 30 meters deep?
Mm-hmm.
Below a residential apartment complex?
Maybe.
Yeah. That's very precise intelligence. Thank you, U.S. Naval Institute. I guess the plausibility is that you were told that, or how did you know, huh?
Mm.
Yeah. And, yeah, Nasrallah's gone, but so are... last night alone, Saturday 5th October, 30 airstrikes in Beirut and elsewhere in southern Lebanon. All Israeli, or as Joe's suggesting, Israeli. Last night was the heaviest night yet. And in this report from the Turkish news agency, if you do a search for at least, as a summary, as of today, at least 2,036 people have been killed, over 9,500 injured, and 1.2 million displaced, according to Lebanese authorities. Remember, Lebanon's population maxes out at 6 million people. 2,000 killed just in the last, I think since this began around late September 23rd or so, so in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And the footage is crazy. I mean,
it's the same MO as Gaza, really, but just, you know, slightly slower, you know, I suppose. But if it continues on...
Well, how are they going to... Yeah,
well,
this is the question. Are they going to Gaza, Beirut?
No, I don't think practically they can't do that, but they can do a lot of damage, you know. They don't care. The thing is, they can't stop now, really, you know, and whether this is the Israeli government, you know, it's difficult. Like, the U.S. is really front and center in all of this, because the U.S. ultimately doesn't care, because it's not America, you know. Israel is America's, like RK Jr. said, it's their forward operating base, it's their beachhead, whatever. It doesn't care about Israel's reputation in that respect. It doesn't care about, you know, they take the long view that we can, you know, press Netanyahu will be gone, somebody else will come along, whatever, you know. So in terms of the livelihood or the threat to Israeli citizens, Jews in Israel, the Washington establishment doesn't care, you know, what danger they put them in. It's a little bit more delicate for any existing member of the Israeli government who lives in Israel. They, as much as they may be a bunch of psychos, they still, you know...
They have enough awareness that this is their nest.
They have more skin in the game in a certain sense, yeah. So that might make them more inclined, for example, towards a ceasefire as long as it was on their terms and all that kind of stuff. But the US would like, you know, to has its own agenda in terms of, getting rid of any opposition to American interests in the Middle East. You know, it's like, as RFK said, like, we may as well
revisit his comments.
His comment here, RFK's comment, but.
And I mean, they were made before he went MAGA, by the way.
Yeah.
He was still the Kennedy Democrat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he was, yes, and he wasn't lamenting it. No, he was just giving a justification for what's happening in the Middle East, or American interest, or American
maybe
involvement.
Maybe answering
in the Middle
East. Why are you so for Israel?
Yeah.
Don't know what the question was, but.
Israel disappeared. Russia and China would be controlling the Middle East, and they control 90% of the world's oil supply, and that would be cataclysmic for U.S. national security.
And we said a bit more than that, but yeah, that's the essence of it. It'd be cataclysmic for U.S. national security. There's that term, U.S. national security. What does that mean? Well, it means everything. It means everything that is America in terms of America's influence and control in the world, and its economy. It's hegemony, basically. That would be critical for, that would be catastrophic for U.S. hegemony, U.S. control, and therefore by implication, the U.S. economy, the livelihoods of all Americans. So he's got skin in the game when he's supporting Israel. And he's not supporting Israel. He's supporting a shitty little country, or a piece of land that is held and owned by, and the shitty little country references a French politician.
French foreign minister once said it 30
years ago, called it that. But anyway, it's a small, relatively small piece of land, but very strategically placed. And it's basically, it's a, you can look at it from the American point of view, you look at it as a giant
base,
military base, a very large military base. And we don't give those up easily. And it's a very good military base, because military bases can be attacked or, you know, destroyed because it's a military target. But this is, this one's got like 6-7 million people in it, living in it. It's a developed, modern city, country with a few large cities. So it's very useful in that respect, you know what I mean? It's not as easily attacked, and you've got the whole, you know...
But the US has bases all over the Middle East.
I know, but those are military bases, but not as big as Israel.
But there's very hardly any US troops in Israel.
Well, if you imagine you go... Imagine you're American, you go and you put a military base in some country that doesn't... You finagled it some way, but you got in there and you got a military base or a few military bases set up, you know? Long term, you don't know what kind of way the country's going to evolve and stuff, and if there's resistance or, you know, resentment about there being a US military base there, a lot of popular pressure can come on board to get rid of it, and political pressure.
Like Iraq these days.
Yeah, it's difficult to hold it long term, you know, but when your military base is actually a country full of, with 6 million people in it, then it's a lot...
It's more reliable.
Well, who's gonna vote to get rid of American...
Well, the entire country's raison d'etre depends on the United States.
Yeah.
And vice versa, of course. Yeah. Dependency.
So it's very important. As Kennedy just said, it's national security. Russia, China in particular, stopping them getting, more control or full control over the Middle East than it going east, basically, in that sense. The same reason that they have been fighting for years to stop Europe. Western Europe looking east and pulling them all into NATO. They don't want the Middle East to go, or not there, the Middle East in general, but Israel, but the Middle East in general, from falling into that Eurasian mishmash, you know what I mean, or the Eurasian continent, let's say.
Ukraine is to the US what Israel is to the US-ish. It's much newer.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Israel's special. Israel's very special, you know what I mean, in the sense that, you know, we have no other home, you know, they just moved there. Ukraine's different in a certain sense. Ukraine ultimately, over long term, could end up going back towards Mother Russia, you know, it could fall back into the arms of Mother Russia, because it was there before. Israel was never anywhere before. Mm-hmm. Israel only exists as the creation, as the brainchild of Americans, to a large extent, at least in its modern... At least in its current configuration, so it has nowhere to go back to, you know, Israel, and the Jews are being continually terrorized in Israel. That, you know, anti-Semitism rising all over the world, that kind of stuff. There's no safe place other than Israel, but Israel is increasingly the least safe place
on the planet.
It's looking more and more unsafe for, and it's just sad. It's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, you see Israel antagonizing its neighbors, and again, like this is an American agenda, I think. Even more so than an Israeli agenda, it's an American agenda, and they're inciting the, in all sorts of ways, inciting the Israelis to continue to antagonize their neighbors and escalate to the point that they hope, obviously, they'll get to use Israeli military might and American combined with American military might to make the Middle East safe forever or for a long time for American interests. But I think ultimately what's going to happen is that Israel is going to be destroyed in one way or another, and America will be kicked out of
Iran, possibly.
Maybe.
On the way.
And America will be kicked out of the Middle East to a large extent. It'll be kicked out of places progressively around the world, and eventually it'll achieve through what it's doing right now what it's trying to avoid, which is the kind of collapse of the American... collapse of American hegemony. So it's kind of very predictable, you know. It's foreseeable. You just watch it happening. You know, you see it happening. You can see where this is going, but nobody's listening. You know, nobody's aware enough to do anything about it, and you wouldn't be able to tell them anyway. And like we've said this before, that it's they're damned if they do and damned if they don't, you know. That's the way they see it anyway. They're damned if they do, damned if they don't. I think they're
far less damned if they don't, because they can withdraw smartly. That's obviously what the Trump faction intends if they get back into the White House. Kind of a quasi-acknowledgement of multipolarity. But we're not going down like, you know, wimps.
We're gonna fight
strategically, rather than, because they bitch about Ukraine, they bitch about the trillions they spent on the Middle East post 9/11. They all agree that was, let's say they agree that it was piss poor job of whatever it is that
I think
the ultimate imperial managers are trying to do.
I think they would have to tighten their belt seriously regardless.
Yeah.
Because they've got to the position that they're in today through foul means, not fair means. And if they were to go back towards more fair means, basically it means that they would have to let things develop out naturally, based on a natural order, based on geographics and geopolitical considerations, without forcing anything, let those things develop. You would have had, you know, as we saw over the past 20 years or so, we saw, you know, Russia becoming more integrated into Europe and all that kind of stuff, especially through energy supplies and all that kind of stuff. And then this Ukraine war is a way to stop that from happening. You know, so they feel that they're terrified of any of that kind of thing happening, because they feel they'd lose Western Europe to Russia, that there would be an alignment, an economic and energy alignment between Russia and Europe and Western Europe, and that then means leads to a political alignment. And America is ultimately left out in the cold, you know, at least, you know, relatively compared to the way it is today, like going dominating the globe, you know. And that's all translates down to a serious economic hit that they're not willing to take. A hit economically and also prestige, influence, that kind of stuff. You know, you won't have... There's a personal aspect to it as well, where, you know, US diplomats won't be able to go around the world and be feted and have open doors and, yes, welcome, Mr. Ambassador, we're so happy to have you here, have the finest food and wine, and, you know, we'll do wonderful deals with you, yes, yes, whatever you want, yes, how high should we jump, yes. Losing all that. They don't feel like it. They kind of like it the way it is, has been for the past 60, 70, 80 years, you know.
Yeah.
And, they look at all the top down, the way it would all transform, and they're just like, nah, this is existential. Of course, they call it existential, they call it national security, all that kind of stuff. But, and yeah, it is, but they're speaking for themselves for the most part. I mean, they can pretend to say, well, we're doing this in the interest of the American people. These stupid Americans who protest against our wars overseas and all that kind of stuff, they don't realize that the only reason they have the big cars and the big houses, blah, 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 and the standard of living and the freedom and all that kind of stuff is because we're waging those wars. You know, we can never tell them because they're too sensitive and too emotional to be able to understand that or accept that you have to break a few eggs to make a big fat American omelette with blueberry pancakes and stuff, you know, and those eggs happen to be in other countries. It's a conundrum for those people.
Couldn't you argue, as the Chinese have done, that it's precisely the 6 or 7 trillion they spent post 9/11 on those wars that has brought them already into the reality they're trying to avoid, which is tightening the belts, like through the 2008 financial crisis, increasing poverty, increasing mismanagement across the board, increasing taxation, you know, stifling. Is it not the very things that they're doing? I know, I hear you. When you say that, I have John Bolton in my head saying, no, the wars are the reason we're still number one, baby.
Mm.
But surely the wars are also bleeding them financially.
Yes, you're stuck. Downwards. What do you do? Well, just keep on doing what we've always done. We, you know, everything looks like a... all you've got is a hammer, you know, and everything looks like a nail. So, yeah, they're not very creative. You know, and yeah, they want to win. They want to be dominant. Someone who's been in a dominant position for so long is going to find it very difficult to take a to reconfigure themselves, you know, psychologically, economically, culturally.
There must be, like, imagine if there were accounts we can't see, but those in power can see them. That make it immediately makes it's obvious, makes sense to them as to why they need to continue that way. We get a few intimations of it now and then. Putin, in one of his speeches in the last year or two, gave a figure of like the United States owes the global South as a whole something like $45 trillion. Not in, he didn't use reparations because slavery. No, we had more specific reasons for what went into the accounts that gave that figure.
Yeah.
Resource allocation, maybe. Right.
What they've extracted.
Extracted
compared
deals,
to what they give back in aid.
Massively undercut pricing and price gouging and mm-hmm. all sorts of pirate-like behaviors around the world.
Mm-hmm.
That was one intimation. What was the other one I had in mind? Escapes me now, but I think it was an answer someone gave as to why they should keep funding 800 overseas bases.
Hmm.
Anyway, but actually another one comes from another direction. Someone who doesn't like Putin at all, Yanis Varoufakis, who in his detailed book, The Global Minotaur, makes a case that effectively everyone outside the United States, every time they purchase anything, whether it's publicly or private sector,
uh-huh.
is paying a tithe. There's a hidden cost in the transaction you're making. And he said it's about 2% in every single transaction globally. A 2% tithe is going to the U.S. government. Not directly. It might have to go through many, many more steps before it hits a bank in Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a 2% tithe on all transactions. So in your mind, you could imagine it. He said, if you had a global map, the capital inflows into New York, and ultimately all those tributaries form into this giant river. And so that's the other...
Yeah. So, yeah, I think they realised...
Hidden accounts.
Yeah, they realised very well that they'd be screwed one way or another, you know. They may realise the problems with the track they're on now, although I doubt it, but maybe they might realise that, look, this isn't the best policy, but in terms of, you know, stoking revolutions, igniting wars in different places and fomenting wars in different places around the world to keep control, because it could all blow up in our faces, but the alternative is worse. Lesser two ills, right? But like I was saying, I think that it's going to happen regardless. So you have people who are on a one way track here, you know, a train to nowhere, a train to destruction, basically. The train track is out down the track, you know, goes off a cliff. But they're just, you know, what can you do? You know, can't stop now, you know. And that's the same thing in the Middle East, like we were saying, they can't stop now, you know. And even if Israel, some elements within the Israeli government want to stop because they have some skin in the game in the sense of, look, we are actually exposed here. Like, you know, we have some concern for our people.
The 40,000 people who can't get back into their homes in the north.
Right. But even all the rest of the people in the country, you know, who'd be under threat from, you know, attack by Iran or other Lebanon or Syria, wherever, Iraq. You know, we do have a bit of, you know, we do have some concern for how that would go down, you know. And
so what you're saying is the Israeli American regime is the lesser of the two evils.
No, they're pretty...
Depending on...
It's a match made in heaven between the two of them, you know, to be honest. So a match made in hell, rather.
Yeah.
So yeah, as has happened in the past, we noted it on Sunday nights, on Sunday evenings, for some reason. Sunday evenings may... I don't know, is it... What is a Sunday? Sunday isn't even a special day in Judaism, is it? It's like a Saturday's the Shabbat, the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Sunday's a day of rest or something, or it's when you, I don't know, you have a bit of fun.
I think it's just the first day of the week for them.
Yeah.
Trying to get back to work.
That's when you get back to work, there you go.
So shit usually happens.
Right, you don't do it on a Saturday, you do it on back to work on a Sunday, right? So we've noticed in the past that these kind of things tend to happen on Sunday evenings. After we've done a show and then we're like a week late type thing. Back a week later and we go, oh, that shit happened just after we got off the air. But yeah, it's not obviously all the time, but there's a bit of a pattern there. So we'll see. But the more Israel carries on with what they're doing, the more they're going to engender international disdain, rejection for what they're doing, and they're going to lose more and more friends. And then what they'll do is, like they've always done, is they'll just cry anti-Semitism and say, like Bibi said there during the week, you know, he said in response to Macron, you know, so Macron made the comment that they should stop sending weapons to Israel because they're going a bit far. And Netanyahu took to Twitter. Not only took to Twitter specifically, but he made a video basically to respond to Macron. this person, here he is. This person, I don't know who, Maria Lupus. I don't know who she is. Anyway, she was
anti-COVID doctor.
Yeah, she's a COVID person. Anyway, she says Netanyahu is pissed at Macron. Even the most evil motherfuckers like Macron are backing her at this point. Israel alone, and I don't know, is she supporting Israel there or not? I don't
know. No, she's not.
Not okay. Have a listen to his rationale for, well, his response to Macron, I suppose.
I have a message. I have a message for President Macron. Today, Israel is defending itself on 7 fronts against the enemies of civilization. We're fighting in Gaza against Hamas, those savages who murdered, raped, beheaded, and burned our people on the
7th. Lie.
We're fighting in Lebanon against Hezbollah, the most heavily armed terror organization in the world, which was planning an even greater massacre than October 7th on our northern border, and that has rocketed Israeli towns and cities for nearly a year. We're fighting against the Houthis in Yemen and the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria that together have launched hundreds of drones and missile attacks against Israel. We're fighting against terrorists in Judea and Samaria who are trying to murder civilians in the heart of our cities. And we're fighting against Iran, which last week fired over 200 ballistic missiles directly at Israel, and which stands behind the 7-front war against Israel. As Israel fights the forces of barbarism led by Iran, all civilized countries should be standing firmly by Israel's side. Yet President Macron and some other Western leaders are now calling for an arms embargo against Israel.
How dare they?
Shame on them.
That's what I'm saying.
Is Iran imposing an arms embargo on Hezbollah, on the Houthis, on
Good
Hamas?
Point. Good point.
And on its other proxies?
Good point.
Of course not. The axis of terror stands together. But countries who supposedly oppose this terror axis call for an arms embargo on Israel. What a disgrace.
Disgusting.
Well, let me tell you
Terrible.
This.
What?
Israel will win with or without their support.
You tell them.
But their shame will continue long after the war is won. For in defending ourselves against this barbarism, Israel is defending civilizations against those who seek to impose a dark age of fanaticism on all of us. Rest assured, Israel will fight until the battle is won, for our sake and for the sake of the peace and security of the entire world.
Awesome. Good man yourself. He's such a great guy, doing all that for the whole
world. Peace he's and security. So selfless.
Peace and security.
You know, Hamas.
He referred to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria.
Yeah.
It's the West Bank.
Yeah. Do you know what stood out for me, though? He did it twice, and he did it in his UN speech. 7 nations. That's the current buzzword. At the beginning of the Operation Annihilate Amalek, it was all Dresden. That was a kind of a key word to the West to shut up. This is our turn, baby. Sick. But now it's 7 nations. He's been saying it a lot lately. What is 7 nations? And you notice that to make the stretch, Hezbollah is a nation. It didn't name Iraq, but the militias, the Soleimani stopped.
Nation, I suppose.
Yeah. The Houthis in Yemen are a nation. Those terrorists, i.e. regular Fatah supporters in the West Bank, are a nation. funny how Palestine is and isn't a nation, depending on the... Anyway, he's stretching things to make it fit. Seven. Why?
Because it's in the Bible.
Deuteronomy 7, baby. This is why this is insane. I mean, he obviously doesn't believe this stuff himself, but... you know. And yet... It's weird because he's obviously a secular type. But this scripture, he believes enough to try to make reality fit with a scripture of prophecy. It's insane. Mm-hmm. Deuteronomy 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land and you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, and then it names seven contemporaries, I suppose,
the Canaanites,
Judeans. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you, and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them, do not give your daughters to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your children away from following me to serve other blah, 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 blah. Mm. That's seven nations, and he's that's what he's trying to make today's reality fit with what the Lord said
mm-hmm.
2,500 years.
Yeah, the seven nations, they're all the descendants of Canaan, who was the son of Ham, who was a grandson of Noah. And all these people actually existed, right?
Right. This is a little genealogy, is it?
Yes. It's the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Girgashites. You want to watch out for them, Girgashites. The Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, and the Perizzites. Not parasites, but Perizzites.
I've never even
so you want to watch out for all of that. Israel is, this is just, you know, it's prophecy. Netanyahu's being driven by prophecy here, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. Basically, when he says that kind of thing, I kind of tend to take back sort of what I was saying there about the Israel, the Americans are the ones who are really the belligerent ones, and that they're driving it, if you know what I mean, or that if Netanyahu or anybody around him wanted to kind of calm things down, that they wouldn't be allowed to in a certain sense, you know. I think they're, like I said, the Americans and the Israelis have a joint agenda for different, motivated by different things, if you know what I mean, but
yeah,
different ideology behind it.
Yeah.
But they both have the same goal, let's say.
I wonder, are people hearing the distortion we are?
Don't know.
Has anyone said anything, buddy? No.
It's all right, it's not too bad.
Okay, it's just us then. That's annoying, but anyway, you touched on it, but maybe we should make it explicit that you're suggesting that today's Sunday, so it's time for another strike, another counter strike.
Hmm.
And that would be against Iran because of what happened on Wednesday this week. Everyone's seen the footage, I'm sure. I want to watch some of it again. It was a great show.
Hmm.
It looked really cool. Of course, the IDF and Israel, so no damage done. They've since backtracked, though. Go ahead and play that. That's the Nevatim base in southern Israel, so in the desert. I think these are... they're Arabs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where are they filming that from? Maybe from Gaza? Is it that close?
No, hard to tell.
The IDF had to backtrack because they have since acknowledged damage to those bases, in part because of freely available satellite imagery from like open sources.
Mm-hmm.
Showing that there is damage to runways, several buildings, maybe a few planes. Iran claimed 20 F-35s were taken out. I think that's boasting a bit too much, but probably a few of them. IDF claims no damage to any aircraft. Mm. I think that's horseshit, because I think one of them, one of the hangars, there was a photo and there was a plane in it the day before. Anyway, obviously both sides are going to present the maximal or minimal take on it. But what interested me is that I've seen a few articles in the West where they're like, okay, that was different. Because, of course, this is the second time this year Iran has done this. The first time was
April
after Israel took out someone in the IRGC at their embassy in Damascus. And that one, in a sense, was more spectacular. I suppose it was the first time Iran or anyone else had done that to Israel in its entire existence, direct airstrikes in the country. But this time, they didn't bother with any of the Shahid drones, no cruise missiles, was all ballistic. But clearly, though, it was historic, and yet, obviously from the damage that was photographed, or even filmed, like that guy with the dash cam in his car going down a highway somewhere near Tel Aviv, and one lands like pretty much right next to him. There's no shockwave. There's no big reverberation. There's no debris strewn across the road. The signpost on the motorway doesn't even shake. So clearly there's very low yield warhead in those things. Now, is that because Iran just ain't got it? Or is that because Iran chose very low yield?
Yeah.
Okay.
But like we were saying, you have to be careful with Israel, because they have nukes, you know.
Wow. So does Iran.
Yeah, but Israel's got more.
Not according to our sources.
What sources?
Well,
we never got a number of hundreds or anything like that.
I think we got Iran has more.
More than Israel? No.
No,
I don't think so.
No. Anyway, you still have to be careful, because Israel's more likely to use them.
Yeah.
But are they, though? Remember the MAD threshold governs all?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone gets to use them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Israel would.
If it gets to that, sure, I can see this escalating. But
so would Russia, right?
Well, Russia's made it clear. Mm-hmm. Russia said they kind of threatened last week to change their nuclear stance if two countries partner up to fire high-tech stuff that the proxy country doesn't have. We're considering nukes.
No, they say...
But they say that.
Russian said explicitly that. Putin said explicitly that. If... He basically put them on notice that if they allowed Ukraine to use weapons against... Western weapons against Russia... from Ukraine, that threatened to prevent Russia from achieving its objectives in Ukraine, then they would use nukes. That's part of the nuclear doctrine now. They basically said, just don't even do it, because we'll use nukes if you try and stop us winning. We're going to win. If you try and stop us winning, we'll nuke you. We'll nuke somebody. We'll nuke something. Poland, I don't know, somewhere. We'll leave it unknown for now, obviously, but...
Right.
We'd probably nuke Ukraine. Who knows what the nuke... But that's what they say. That's what Putin says. Because, you know, you can say, well, he's bluffing, and the bottom, obviously the West is always bluff. He doesn't mean it, whatever. So there's a lot of opportunity for bluffing when you've got nukes and stuff, you know, but nobody wants to go there, so...
What you're saying is, tonight, Sunday, Israel could nuke Iran?
No.
No.
But they obviously have to pick... You know, it's about... proportional responses, you know.
Exactly. And that's what Biden said.
What can be
immediately?
What's tolerable? What's tolerable to and because it's like who gets the last slap? You know what I mean? It's like Iran is like look, now we fired our 200 ballistic missiles there last week. Don't respond, because if you do, we'll respond. So it's like, well, no, that's not fair. Israel's like, that's not fair. We get to respond, and then you're the one who has to not respond. No. We responded response.
Yeah.
You respond to our response, then we get to respond to your response, but you don't get to respond to that final, because that's the final response. And they're like, no, we get the final response, and then you... And
so it goes. Biden immediately said Israel has right to respond, but proportionately. Or Biden said, someone told Biden to say. But there was something specific. Biden says Israel shouldn't strike Iranian nuclear sites. Well, why not? I think they know Iran has nukes. That's why they're saying that.
Well, you know who doesn't know?
Because he's implying, there's two meanings to that. One is he's implying, well, Iran has civilian nuclear, plants. And don't bomb those. Cause mm-hmm. what? Because of radiation, possibly? Mm-hmm. I mean, no one's stopping the Ukrainians from targeting mm-hmm. Russian or their own bloody nuclear sites. So I think there's a second meaning in that.
But you know who doesn't know that second meaning? This guy.
Biden.
No, this guy.
Oh. Right. Play. He's not up to date yet. He doesn't know Iran has nukes.
Play.
They asked him, what do you think about Iran? Would you hit Iran? And he goes, as long as they don't hit the nuclear stuff. That's the thing you want to hit, right?
It's the nuclear stuff.
I think you got that one wrong. Isn't that the one you're supposed to hit? I mean, it's the biggest risk we have. Nuclear weapons, the power of nuclear weapons, the power of weaponry. You know, I rebuilt the entire military. Yes, everything. I built
by hand, myself.
Nuclear, and I hated to build the nuclear, but I got to know firsthand the power of that stuff, and I'll tell you what, we have to be totally prepared. We have to be absolutely prepared. But when they asked him that question, the answer should have been, hit the nuclear first and worry about the rest later.
And everybody's like, yeah, hit the nuclear first, yeah.
Great question. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you,
Austin. That was a great question. Thank you. Yeah.
Someone did a meme of that, and it's Trump maybe at this event. And in the background, in the sky, there's like recently dead senators and whatnot. And one of them is John McCain beaming down at him like, yes, war with Iran.
Yeah.
he's finally waiting. No, seriously, that does betray that Trump doesn't know that. They must have kept that from him.
Hmm.
Shit. Did he not know that when he gave... he pushed for it, apparently, the taking out of Soleimani. Well, of course, it's likely that inside Iran, it was agreed.
Well, if you hit civilian nuclear sites, you're going to create a nuclear... kind of disaster, right? You're going to...
Yeah. That's the plausible reason cruel, right? For why they warned them not to do that. But
why would Trump...
Why would they care about a little radiation in Iran?
Depends on how many nuclear sites you hit. But, it's generally not good, so I don't know. It's all going downhill. Bit by bit. We'll have to wait and see. But it's been a year. Tomorrow's a year since it all kicked off. What a year it's been, eh?
Oh, shit, yeah. October 7th.
Maybe tomorrow.
Anniversary.
We see, that's the thing. They're not going to do it on Sunday now. They're going to do it on Monday.
Monday.
Because Monday will be the anniversary. And it'll be...
they'll hate Iran.
This is a symbolic day.
Which will be...
sure resolved.
It will be perfect because it will be prophecy fulfilled, because for an entire year they've convinced themselves that Hamas launched... its operation, whatever they called it, Al-Aqsa flood, because of Iran, Hamas launched it because of Iran.
Mm.
I think by convincing Americans and the West in general, they convinced themselves that that's what happened. So hitting Iran, the terrorist mastermind behind that incident, it's like done and dusted. Of course, there's no... well, maybe not no relation, but maybe there's some relation, but there's very little. This isn't like Hezbollah's help and direct ties to Iran via Syria,
mm-hmm.
Hamas, yeah. You can see plausibly why they've connected the two, that Hamas was just doing Iran's bidding. Because anyone who gets Israel is good for Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that simple. It's just papers over. Go back 10 years, just 10 years, and Hamas had a falling out with Bashar al-Assad when it politically took the side of the Free Syrian Army.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just an oversight where they went, oh, well, we didn't know they were CIA funded. Mm-hmm. No, they fucking knew. And they had to leave. They were at the time, they were guests of Assad in Syria. And they were banking on a regime change in the country of their host.
Mm-hmm.
And Qatar, that's why they relocated to Qatar. Because they're no longer welcome there. Anyway, prophecy, history and all the twists and turns it makes become irrelevant as you get to the crunch. It's like, just make it fit. Seven nations. October 7th, anniversary, hit Iran, who was ultimately caused what happened a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's why I kind of hesitated by saying there's no connection whatsoever. I suppose ideologically there is. You know, most people in Iran want the Zionist entity gone, finished. And that gets spun in Israel, of course, and in the West as, you see, they want to kill us all. No, they just mean regime change. But Israel is, give me a scenario. What are they going to do? Trump's saying, aim big. What are they going to do short of, what is a counter strike on Iran for what they did last Wednesday, short of that satisfactorily prevents an even larger wave of strikes, this time with some actual decent warheads in them, landing on Israel next week?
It wouldn't preclude that, and you may factor in that you're allowing for that, but you just keep it below the threshold. So you target military bases in Iran, oil and gas, maybe infrastructure, or maybe you keep it to military bases. And then Iran gets to fire some more at Israeli military bases, and then they all keep it on the low down in terms of like no destruction to civilian populated areas, no major cities targeted, and just wait until somebody gets tired or something else happens that distracts people.
Okay. In the meantime, Israel day by day escalates civilian terror bombing in Lebanon.
Mm.
Now go back to what we said before. The reason for Hezbollah annoying, we heard Netanyahu say, oh, they were targeting our civilians. How true is that? Was Hezbollah firing at towns? Or they firing at military sites?
No, yeah.
It was military sites.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that expressly. Nasrallah said it himself to try and absorb as much Israeli military attention northwards away from Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's gone now. Does Iran then do that in turn to protect the population of Lebanon? Gaza's 2 million people. Lebanon's 5 million people. If we're on the path where Lebanon is to be Gazed, you know, erased from the ground, as their Bible tells them to do. Who will absorb Israeli attention and military resources? The obvious step up is that it's Iran.
Yeah, but there's nobody in that respect who could draw forces away
because they're not right next to them.
Right, because bombing doesn't take military, unless you can actually take out military equipment and all that kind of stuff and planes, but with those ballistic missiles, I don't think they're accurate enough, you know. Maybe they've got more, maybe they've got others, we'll have to wait and see that they're willing to use, but you're not going to pull any, there's nobody there to pull any Israeli military personnel, tanks and infantry away from Lebanon. Like the Syrians aren't going to get involved to any significant degree. There's not really anybody else. Like there's no army waiting at the border, you know?
Yeah. Did you see the report that the Russian airbase in Latakia was hit? Was that fake news?
Targeted
by Israel.
Yeah.
And was that something next to the base or something Russian? Well, there were no Russian casualties.
There were a couple of missiles. A number of missiles were shot down by Russian air defense.
Okay. So they're finally working. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, it's to protect their own, right?
Yes. So the Israelis did try to send a message to...
I don't know if it was or wasn't. I think they claimed they were targeting
something adjacent.
A Hezbollah thing nearby, but then, you know, how are the Russians meant to know that unless the Israelis tell them, and then if the Israelis tell them, do they even believe them? So maybe the safest option is just shoot it down if it's coming, if its trajectory seems to be heading your way. Yeah. Shoot it down. You don't take any risks, right?
The other thing to note is the report we both saw of a U.S. military cargo plane landing in what we should invent the term for it, because it's been almost 10 fucking years and no one says it, in American-occupied northeast Syria. Supposedly chock full of goodies. And your idea when you tweeted about it was that they may be funneling gear to their... How many are there now? 10,000 more proxies still trapped in Idlib province since 2017. Mm-hmm. What a weird... We stopped talking about it because it became a kind of stalemate, and everyone seems to agree that the whole northern strip of Syria is now Turkish-occupied. The northeast and basically eastern Syria down the Euphrates are American-occupied. The rest is Syrian, Damascus controlled, except for Idlib province, which borders Hatay in Turkey.
Borders Lebanon.
There's a border Lebanon?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't Latakia between it? I think it's right next to Turkey, that little bit of Turkey that they took away from Syria 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's just south of Idlib. Slightly southwest of Idlib is you're into northern Lebanon, and then Latakia's on the coast there and stuff, you know. What you're suggesting is that they could get a bunch of jihadis
to invade
Lebanon
from the north,
yeah.
Or keep Syria occupied while so there is no Iranian or Syrian access through Syria to come to the aid of Lebanon.
Mm.
And then it really is. That's because all things being equal, it's going to go in the direction of Gaza. Because Gaza could happen because it's isolated.
Mm.
And because Egypt won't lift a finger to help. And so Lebanon is...
Yeah, sorry.
Screwed if...
Yeah. It does. I mean, it's in Syria. So, but that's the Russians and the... Yeah, Idlib is north of... you have a bit... You know, I don't know what it is. Maybe 150 kilometers or whatever.
There's a portion of Syria.
North of the northern border of Lebanon. You've got Latakia and south of there. But then, yeah, you go south into Lebanon. From there, but then the Russians are keeping an eye on them.
I know,
I mean,
so and
they
what will
they do? Very far, like, you know what I mean. So they're hemmed in there, and they can't really do much or go very far. So yeah, Russia's playing a kind of controlling game in the whole situation there. You know what I mean? Where it's not allowing any of that kind of nonsense to break out again. You know.
Yeah,
and obviously in Syria, it's protecting Syria and keeping whatever's left of Syria that's Syrian,
but in
sovereign
in
Syrian territory.
In hindsight, isn't it interesting that they're also in a position to protect Lebanon?
Yeah.
And was that done with foresight, or is that just always the case that I think the Soviet, the US, USSR had either at that site or somewhere close to it, they had a port agreement in the same region of the world. Maybe it was just simply,
yeah, they did,
you know, an old agreement that was renewed. But you wonder if Putin and his people had the foresight to see that we need to be right there, like, not in Palmyra, not in the center, not in Damascus.
Mm.
We need to be here because we can keep an eye on Turkey, help Syria, which was the urgent reason for it at the time,
mm-hmm.
and Lebanon
mm-hmm.
when the time comes. Yeah. We'll see. I guess we'll see.
It's a powder keg. Like, a bunch of people all holding guns at each other, you know? Pointing guns at each other.
And for the moment, firing blanks. Well, Iran did. Israel isn't, though. I mean,
No.
These pictures coming out, they're just dumping the bunker busters on mm-hmm. civilians. They hit an orphanage. Was that in Lebanon, the West Bank? They're bombing the West Bank as well.
Yep.
West Bank has no army that I know of. Why is there no resistance in the West Bank? It's been slowly strangled and it's so divided up physically. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do. Mm-hmm. But still, all I've seen since basically 9/11 is protests there.
Yeah, well, there have been some attacks on Israeli, like bulldozers and different, you know, over the past year there have been some, but they have it completely under control for the most part. Like,
yeah.
And there's no Hamas there or whatever, you know, so it's very limited resistance available in the West Bank. I mean, it's, like you said, it's riven with settlements and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's broken in little pieces here and there, totally separated from each other. What kind of resistance do you expect, you know?
Well, I mean, Gaza's tiny. They did something.
But that's because, well, Gaza was contiguous, all full of Palestinians, right? But here you have, I'm talking about in the West Bank, you have like a little pocket here, a little pocket there.
It's even smaller. Elsewhere. There's nothing as big as Gaza that's self-contained.
Not at all, no. Look at a map of it and look at the settlements. The settlements are all over it. Like, it's like pockmarked with them everywhere, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah. The Israelis are vicious, you know. And it's psychologically it fits with people who have who know they're in the wrong in a certain sense. I mean, it's not that they know they're in the wrong, they don't admit that they're in the wrong for having stolen Palestinian land years ago. But when you do that, If I, there's very simple analogies that make it obvious to anybody, right? That anybody can relate to. If there's a community, a neighbourhood of houses, and they've all been living peaceably, well, let's say, not necessarily peaceably, but they all realise they've been there for a long time and they're all united by an identity, an ethnicity, a religion, whatever. They don't always get on, whatever, but they've all lived there for X number of years. Then somebody comes in, a new person comes in, and steals one of the houses, one of the people living in that neighbourhood, sets themselves up and starts to antagonise all their neighbours, you know, forevermore. How do you, and you insist on being the one, you know, these people aren't happy that you've done that, it's on your record that you stole that house, you're not a native from here, and you're being an asshole to all your neighbours. First of all, you're in a minority, which makes you fearful and paranoid. And over the years, you start to suspect that all your neighbours are plotting against you because of what they say. And they say what they say because they're right to say what they say. They keep on saying that you stole that land, which means that they're accusing you of being a thief. And you know what happens to thieves? These people usually, you know, don't treat thieves very well. So these people are not going to treat me very well. They're out to get me. So what do I have to do? Well, I have to defend myself against them. I have to go around checking all their houses and periodically attack their houses and keep them in line. And increasingly as I do that, their anger towards me increases. But they sit back and don't do anything. Because they realise that, well, we've been here a lot longer than you have. We're actually being more and more unified because you're the interloper come into this community and you've kind of, in a certain sense, unified a lot of us against you. And you're becoming increasingly angry and irrational and lashing out at us But we just sit back and go, well, you know, I mean, the bottom line is your position. It's your position. You, the one who's come into this community and stolen a house, your position is untenable. You're the one who's in the untenable position. I mean, you have an option to try and ingratiate yourself and undo all that you've done, but you don't seem to want to take that take that approach. You want to keep antagonizing everybody, and you threaten us and accuse us and attack us and all that kind of stuff. So people in that position who are the natives, let's say, of that area, of that part of the world, are tend to be much more relaxed, less aggressive, less violent than the interloper. You can always identify the interloper because that's the one that has slowly over the years developed, or maybe from the very beginning, developed the mentality of a cornered rat. Because they kind of are, but it's their own fault. And when a rat's cornered, or any animal's cornered, whatever, it'll be violent and aggressive. And it's not that it's cornered, it's actually put itself in the corner.
Mm-hmm. Everyone else accepts that that's their house now.
Right. Although
they all agreed, can we just put the guns down?
Well, no, not necessarily. Well, they agree that there's no military solution to this, but you do need to pay reparations to the person you stole the house from.
Is that part of the 1967 agreement of two-state solution? The right of return of Palestinian refugees, is it baked into that?
West Bank and
West Bank goes back. So yes, effectively, all your settlers have to leave.
All your settlers have to make right what you've done. You can't keep making it worse and worse. You can't keep taking over more and more land. And abusing, continuing to abuse the people that you evicted. That has to stop. We don't have to fight over it. We don't have to go to war over it. But you have to stop doing that. But Israel's like, no. Not only do I not want to give this house back, not only do I not want to stop persecuting the people that I kicked out of this house, but I want your house too. And they're like, well,
try and take it.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, whatever. But they can't take the house. They know they can't. They make those kind of threats, whatever, but they can't do much else. So they just attack. They lob rocks at everybody else's house, you know. And ultimately, it's the other countries in the region just go, look, this isn't going anywhere. And particularly, it's not going anywhere good for you. You can't. There's no positive outcome of your trajectory here. So we'll just sit and wait. We'll defend ourselves, and we'll try and keep you from doing anything more, anything worse. But ultimately, you're going to have to come back to the negotiating table and make amends for what you've done. And all Israel can say in response to that is, God give me this land and fuck all of you.
Yeah.
And that's basically their argument. So, yeah, it's a train wreck. And when I say it's a train wreck, I mean, it doesn't mean that there can't be a lot of kind of chaos and war and disaster in the Middle East. But ultimately, the country that obviously is going to come out worst from all of this is Israel.
Yeah. Yeah. And the others almost... Yeah, they can be far more relaxed about having to do something about it. You wonder if, well, it's a big if because it's been 40 years, if Iran was not as ideologically committed to defending the Palestinians as it is, I suppose then Israel would say, well, yeah, we'd be fine with that. But if it wasn't an ideologically anti-Zionist Iran, it'd be something else, you suspect. There'd be some other phantasm in their minds that would have created a reality that had someone threaten them that they could present to the world and see, we have to keep being like this because they make it like this, you know?
Mm. Well, their mistake from the very beginning was not dealing with it, you know, and as cruel as it sounds, when they invaded... overran Palestine and set up a state of Israel, they should have gotten rid of all the Palestinians at that point. One way or another, they should have gotten rid of them all. And then they'd done it relatively quickly. They would have had, now, today, they would have had a history of, you know, 70 years for everything to settle down and normalize. You know, but imagine moving in, stealing someone's house, putting them in a shack out the back and letting them stay there. And think, what are you going to... You think those people are just going to stay there and be happy? Do you think that you think maybe they're going to try and take their house back periodically? Yeah. So it's ridiculous. Like, the whole situation is absolutely ridiculous. To think that it would not have, it wasn't a recipe set up from the very beginning to create a long drawn out protracted conflict, you know, boiling over periodically. It's like, you set it up that way. So it would do that, and it was absolutely foreseeable that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And then, so, and by allowing Palestinians to continue to exist, and by allowing Palestinians to continue to exist, they allowed Palestinians to continue to resist, basically attack them, etc., etc., and that then garners the support of other countries in the region. And especially if you send diaspora, you did kick a lot of people did leave and go into other countries.
Oh yeah, Jordan.
And they're all supportive of the people back in Palestine. So it's like, yeah, the whole thing is just...
Can't stop the signal now.